The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. Earnings season kicking into high gear this past week with the likes of Netflix, Twitter, and Tesla all reporting. We're going to have some thoughts on the EV giant.
Also ahead, this year's crypto carnage is an opportunity for FTX co-founder and CEO Sam Bankman-Fried. We're going to explain what he's been up to and what his ambitions are.
Also, growth in luxury travel. We'll talk about that with the CEO of Montage International. And our Business Week cover story, America's complicated multi-year effort to create air traffic control rules for drones. All of that to come. We begin this hour with a timely and global story featured in this week's economics section.
Americans love their stuff, Carol, and our big spending ways, that coupled with a supercharged dollar, they are boosting prices around the world. Bloomberg News economics editor Ben Holland co-wrote the story. He and Businessweek editor Joel Weber help explain how the U.S. is now exporting inflation and why Fed interest rate hikes will only make it worse.
So I think it's happening in two ways. So the first thing is that all over the world in the pandemic, you had this kind of change in what people were buying, right? So people weren't buying gym memberships, they weren't buying restaurant meals, they weren't going on vacation so much, they were buying goods. They were buying exercise bikes and TV sets. But this shift was much bigger in the United States than in other countries, and it's lasted for longer. And it's been amplified by the way that some of the big U.S. retailers have been behaving, because we know now that people like Walmart and Target built up huge inventories of stuff. So they were basically buying even more stuff than American consumers wanted to buy, which was already a lot. And because supplies of all these goods, which are traded on global markets, were constrained by COVID, the effect of Americans buying so much of them was to push their prices up for other countries, too.
Also joining us, of course, is Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, and he's here in our Interactive Broker studio. Hey, Joel.
Hi. So, Ben, I wanted to ask you, you know, how is this manifesting itself? You know, we've seen in what happens when, you know, we get a glut of inventory in America, and if this is getting pushed out, like, how is it showing up elsewhere?
So it does show up in the inflation numbers in other countries. But if you look at a place like Europe, then, of course, in the headline numbers, it's this effect is swamped because, you know, the biggest driver of higher inflation is energy and food, you know, a lot of which is the result of the Ukraine war. But you are seeing higher prices of imported goods by comparison with goods that are produced domestically in European countries. And then the new side of it that we're starting to see now, of course, is that the fix to this, you know, this problem, if you want a very strong American demand, is higher American interest rates. Well, that is knocking the dollar much higher. We now have like a very, very strong dollar. And that makes the inflation problem for other countries even worse in a way, because it means that stuff they buy from America or stuff that is priced in dollars like oil and other commodities also become more expensive for them.
And I feel like, you know, this is not something that it's a touch and go, Ben. And this is why we continue to see the inflationary problems globally, you know, sticking with us even longer than maybe we had all hoped.
Yeah, I think so, because this is something that could outlast some of the other causes of inflation. So even if European energy and food problems were to sort of magically disappear, or if they were, you know, that inflation was to fade away, this other stuff caused by a strong dollar, for example, might still be around, and it might still keep inflation higher than the central bankers in Europe would be comfortable with.
Okay, so the Fed pretty much going to keep raising rates for a while. So how much worse is this problem going to get?
I mean, it could potentially get worse. I mean, the caveat, of course, is that, you know, as I said, the headline inflation in places like Europe is really an energy story. But it could be that even when that goes away, that they are still left with a problem, which is caused by, you know, first strong American demand and then second the very strong dollar that makes their life harder. And another thing to think about here is that it also makes the job of a central banker harder. Because if you're the Fed, if you're the American central bank and you think that American inflation is at least partly being caused by strong American demand. Well, that's something you can do something about. But it leaves the European Central Bank, for example, in a situation where their inflation is not being caused by, you know, European consumers going out and buying lots of stuff, and yet they still feel like they have to raise rates, and the result might be that they just slow their economy down without really doing much to address the root of the problem.
Why did Americans buy stuff at a different rate than other countries during the pandemic?
Part of it is just that the patterns of what people buy are different in different countries to start with before the pandemic. But I think in the pandemic, probably the biggest reason why that shift was bigger and longer lasting in America was that the United States did a bigger fiscal stimulus than European countries, for example. Because it couldn't really have been that the other side of it, the supply stuff, you know, it was harder to do here because you know, more restaurants were closed in Europe than the United States, right? So
one of the things I love in your story is you talk about the two economies may have similar rates of inflation. You're talking about Europe and the U.S., but they have different kinds with major implications, again, for how the banks tackle the problem. But you talk about, you know, the distinction boiling down to how big a share of price pressures is homegrown. And we really need to look at internally where the inflationary pressures are within each country.
Yeah. And what you see when you do look at that, I think, is really reinforces the point that you know, more of it is homegrown in the United States than Europe. And that, in a way, that makes the job of the Fed easier, I think, compared with the job of other central banks. Because, as I said, if you think that part of your high inflation in America is caused by strong American demand, well, that's something the American Central Bank can do something about. They can raise interest rates and they can cool down that demand. If you're Europe and none of your inflation is really being caused by strong European demand, but you still have very high inflation and you want to do something about it and you're worried about expectations getting entrenched, the risk is that you raise interest rates, but all you're really doing is slowing down your own economy.
So if I heard our guest right, the Fed has it easy, right, Carol?
I guess so.
Yeah, between a rock and a hard place, that's what I'd say.
All right. That was Bloomberg News economics editor Ben Holland, along with Businessweek editor Jill Weber.
Coming up, Elon Musk, well, he's done it again. How Tesla defied expectations for yet another earnings beat. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This past week, Tesla reported second quarter earnings that beat Wall Street estimates, the company getting production back on track while also tackling supply chain hurdles and COVID lockdowns at its factory in China. CEO Elon Musk had this to say on the earnings call.
With regard to manufacturing and technology, about 5 or 6 years ago, we said we wanted to become the best manufacturer in the world, and that is somewhat counterintuitively to some people. What will actually be, I think, our strongest competitive advantage.
So let's get right to it with somebody who is a Tesla owner and investor, well-known to our audience. We're talking about Ross Gerber.
Ross Gerber is president and CEO at Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He joins us on the phone from Santa Monica, California. Ross, pick out one number in this earnings report and tell us why it's your favorite.
Earnings per share. They beat by a big number in a very, very, very tough environment while they're ramping two factories. And boy, they really killed it.
Okay, that number, $2.27, Ross, for the second quarter. Estimates were for $1.83. So blowing it out of the park when it came to that bottom line.
Yeah, and it's like so hard with supply chain and all the issues with China. And here they come out with a huge margin on their vehicles with the ramp. I mean, it's just, they executed amazingly well.
So how are they doing it when so many others seem to be struggling?
Well, there's a couple things that Tesla has as a huge advantage over other automakers. And it first started when Elon went out and cut supply deals with like lithium companies and battery cell companies. He already had the vision of like, we want 10-year contracts. We want guaranteed supply. Like, he went all in and did like huge deals with these suppliers early on before electric vehicles were even an issue. So he's kind of gets the priority because he makes the most cars and he committed the most early. And so he has the best position. Plus, they're completely vertically integrated. So they really have an advantage over other players in the EV space. You know, I think the most important thing is the valuation of Tesla is very high relative to the market. So they need to have good earnings to support their stock price and such.
What's the important valuation metric to watch? I mean, I'm just looking at basic PE is almost 88 right now, forward-looking PE of about 63. What is the important metric to look at when we're trying to value something like a Tesla, which most would argue is still a mega growth company?
Right. So we value all companies based off their PE to growth ratio. So that's really what's important is how fast is the company growing relative to its PE. And that's really where you can get stock price appreciation because you see this multiple will be forced in a way lower as E goes up if P doesn't go up. So P usually goes up when E goes up. Hmm. So the nice way to look at it is because Tesla is beating earnings and growing so fast, their growth rate is well over 100% of earnings, but their PE is less than 100. So relative to other stocks in the stock market, it is actually very cheap. I really want to know what's happening in Berlin and Austin as far as the ramp, where they are with production, and what's going on with the 4680 cell ramp, because that seems to be sort of a little, you know, hiccup that they're dealing with right now. So I'm really concerned about technology also for full self-driving. And, you know, I've been using the software and it's getting better and better, but what's their time frame for a wide release, which I think...
How much better is it getting? Because, you know, there were some videos that made the rounds just a couple weeks ago with some really concerning. I think Galileo Russell posted it a few weeks ago. And he's a big Tesla bull. We've had him on our program before. And it showed it the vehicle turning right down the wrong way down a one-way street. I'm sure you saw that video, Ross. How much better is it getting? Because that's pretty bad.
You know, I think that I've seen, like, so many humans just today do stupid things like that. You know, it's really, like, hard to be a perfect car while you're...
You do live in L.A.
So that...
You know, I'm a Californian,
yeah,
so I can say that.
And then I chain my car in L.A., and it's super hard. You know, it's super hard to survive in L.A. So I think the expectation that a computer will have a flawless driving ability when it's not even... It's still a beta, and then you get on the road and you watch humans like kill each other on the road daily, we're setting two standards. You see what I'm saying? Mm. And so, well, like, full self-driving is never going to be perfect.
Well, that's
somebody's
what
somebody's going to get run over.
That's what I want to ask. Like, Ross, is full self-driving crucial to the Tesla story, or can it just be a great EV car maker and that's enough?
Well, it's crucial to the story if you think about it, that making an EV isn't a challenge for Tesla anymore. So Tesla as a company, where would they evolve to if they were just an EV maker? Because eventually everybody's going to be making EVs and it'll become a commodity.
Well, there's the human robot. There's the human robot that I'm kind of obsessed
right.
with.
But that's all about AI, though. That's not really about, like, building a robot isn't hard. It's about making a smart robot that can do good stuff, you know? And so, so the future is the software. And I think you should look at it very much like Apple. You know, the Samsung phones are just as good as the Apple phones, or better, okay? The Google phones are just as good or better. But we all use iPhones because of the software, and the way the software interacts with our life keeps us involved with Apple forever. And that's what Tesla's building with the software that the other companies don't have.
Right.
So when you're talking about an EV being a commodity in 10 years, it will be.
Got it.
But the software is where the value is.
That was Tesla owner and investor Ross Gerber, president and CEO at Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He joined us just after Tesla's latest earnings release on Wednesday afternoon.
It was a big report, important report. And I feel like, Tim, so many different moving parts, right?
Yeah.
We were really curious about, of course, what's going on with Twitter. But Tesla and its supply chain and being to produce all the cars that are in demand, getting an update on that was important.
Yeah, and also an update on the factory in Shanghai after a really tough quarter when it comes to lockdowns and production.
And it sounds like what he had to say is that in terms of supply chains, things seem to be maybe easing. Tesla's quarterly update also included a sale of a significant chunk of its stake in Bitcoin. This year's crypto round has erased about $2 trillion in market value overall from the digital currency. Elon Musk and Tesla did it to increase liquidity after that Shanghai shutdown, and that the sale should not be seen as, quote, some verdict on Bitcoin. Sounds like classic Elon.
Yeah, it does sound like classic Elon. Crypto, by the way, was a big topic this week at the Bloomberg Crypto Summit, bringing together top names in the world of tokens, blockchains, NFTs, and more. Despite the poor performance so far in 2022, many of the attendees remain bullish on the crypto industry, including one well-known voice, that's FTX co-founder and CEO Sam Bankman-Fried.
Certainly the asset price decline was a strong sign that in crypto and frankly in a lot of fintech, things were way too light on use cases and that there was a lot of hand-waving going on, both on use cases and on financial modeling that was suspect.
Up next, hear how the crypto billionaire is using the downturn to execute a deal-making spree unlike any other in the industry's, I guess you could call it, brief history.
Stick around. This is Bloomberg.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
This week, the Bloomberg Crypto Summit hosted some of the industry's biggest names, including in person. And this is kind of rare, right, Tim? He often does things virtually.
Yeah, he does. But, you know, he was looking the part.
In shorts and a T-shirt. We're talking about Sam Bankman-Fried, or as our next guest, our reporter, calls him, crypto's patron saint.
In June, he pumped about $1 billion into the industry, even as digital asset prices continued to fall. The market has seen roughly $2 trillion of value erased in a span, Carol, of just 8 months.
It's unbelievable. Well, in a story you'll find in the finance section of Bloomberg Business Week, Bloomberg News digital currencies and venture capital reporter Hannah Miller tells us why the FTX co-founder and CEO remains undeterred.
Sam Bankman-Fried has really spotted a lot of opportunities here to just consolidate power over the industry, whether it's striking deals with BlockFi or Voyager Digital. He's really, you know, just spreading his influence.
All right, remind us, for those who are like, wait, who is this dude? Because he really is a standout among those who are in this space, because he's worth a lot of money, right? He's probably lost some, but he's still worth a lot.
Yeah, he's worth about $10 billion currently to our Billionaires Index. That's about half of where his wealth was in April. Obviously still a lot of money. But he's 30 years old. He's taken the industry by storm. His companies, FTX and Alameda Research, have really asserted power within the industry. They work with a lot of top names. FTX is one of the most used crypto exchanges in the world.
So he's doing all of this out of the goodness of his heart, or does he just want to dominate and be the industry?
A lot of people within the industry see him as crypto's patron saint, that he is stepping in, bailing out companies out of the goodness of his own heart. But others see a business motivation here. He's really buying companies on the cheap. He is stepping in. He's helping out. But there's also a huge advantage in expanding his own business and gaining customers all over the world, particularly in the U.S.
Tell us more about what he's like and who he is and how he got into crypto.
Yeah, no. Sam is always great to talk to. We spoke to him for this story. He is described by people as kind, nerdy, shy, a little bit awkward, but he really has a very calculating eye when he looks at the industry. He got into crypto trading a few years back, really sort of climbed the ranks in terms of trading performance with Alameda Research. And he really has become kind of a cult figure within the industry. And he's also pledged to give away most of his vast personal wealth.
While he's spending and buying and looking to dominate when it comes to crypto, he's passed on some of the big flops as of late.
That's true. We have in our reporting that he spoke with Terra and Celsius about potential bailouts there, but he ended up passing on both. So it shows that he does have a discriminating eye here. He's not just bailing out whoever. He's looking for advantages. He's looking at how it can help him and his companies.
What about when it comes to Robinhood?
Yeah, no, we reported a few weeks back that he was looking into a potential takeover at Robinhood. This shows that he has his eyes beyond the crypto industry, that he's looking at sort of more traditional finance players. As one of my sources said, his ambitions know no bounds. So it's really exciting to see him look at other areas. I mean, he's even joked about buying Goldman in the past.
That is wild. Well, he wants to do bigger deals, it sounds like. Hannah, what is it that we need to understand about this individual? As the crypto space, still many who are knowledgeable, understand how it works, who are entrenched in this industry, say we're very early on in terms of the impact of the digital crypto world. So why is it that we need to keep an eye on him and what he does?
Well, I think with this current crypto winter, the industry is at a crossroads. A lot of people want a decentralized industry where power is in the hands of the people, that it's based on peer-to-peer transactions. But Sam's influence and that of FTX shows that there are clear centralized elements here, that there are major players to watch, and that they are going to have continued influence as this space grows.
So what are you watching to see in terms of what he does next?
Yeah, so we already know, and we reported that FTX and FTX US are looking to raise more funding, which is pretty interesting during this time because I've written a lot about how funding from venture capitalists has slowed when it comes to crypto. So he is definitely looking to expand. He has also spoken about buying assets from other distressed companies and even targeting Bitcoin miners.
That was Bloomberg's digital currencies and venture capital reporter, Hannah Miller.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Despite Elon Musk's optimism over easing supply chains, coming up next, we'll hear from Audi of America's sustainability chief, who says finding the perfect new ride, well, it could be tough in the near term.
Unquestionably, the supply is constrained. Demand is up. So it's all of the events on the supply side and the demand side have made it more difficult to get the car of your choice these days.
Your best options in the luxury car market explained, and the latest on the push to electrify America's highways and byways. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
It's happening globally. The U.S., the latest country to cross the electric car tipping point for mass adoption. For the past 6 months, the U.S. joining Europe and China, collectively the three largest car markets, and moving beyond the 5% tipping point. If the U.S. follows the overall trend established by 18 countries that came before it, a quarter of new car sales could be electric by the end of 2025. That would be a year or two ahead of most major forecasts. That's significant. That's just a few years away.
It doesn't hurt that gas prices are, you know, more than $4.50 a gallon nationally.
That'll
Carol.
Shove you in a different direction, right? All right, so let's see how the folks over at Audi are tackling this dramatic shift in our world. We welcome Spencer Reeder, Director of Sustainability and Government Affairs at Audi of America. He is with us via Zoom from Sacramento, California. Spencer, nice to have you here with Tim and myself. How are you?
Great. Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about the different factors that are impacting the shift, the global shift to EVs. If I think about, you know, Tim just mentioned energy prices. We look at, you know, how they have shot up because of the Russian war in Ukraine, the regulatory shift, climate change. What do you think is the biggest factor that's maybe making everybody shift to EVs a lot faster than maybe was originally forecast?
Well, listen, I think you nailed it with the energy prices, right? I mean, just even anecdotally myself, and I've been driving an EV for a while, the amount of inquiries I get just from neighbors and others on the streets here in California, and you know, keep in mind, you guys know this, but the $4.50 sort of $4.60 a gallon is would be a bargain here in California, right? I mean, we're closer to $6 a gallon, depending on the day of the week. It is the economics. It's the economics of it for families, for individuals, when they see what they're paying at the pump. And so EVs now become much more in view, on the radar for consideration. And I think it's a, you know, it's a fortunate coincidence of events. There's a lot more product. The product's better. There's more, I think, people intersecting others in their world, whether it's a family member or someone at work that's driving an EV. So it's in people's consciousness, and now you have the energy prices, which you're really focusing the mind.
But still hard to get a lot of these EVs because of components that are involved in the manufacturing process, particularly the chips and then, of course, just the raw materials that go into developing the batteries. Spencer, give us an update on how long someone has to wait if they order an EV from Audi.
Oh, it depends on the model and what kind of options you want. If you want a specific color, of course, if you're willing to take any color. So all of those factor into the times. And I'd be wrong if I gave you any particular number. But it's more than a few days unless you happen to get lucky and go into a dealership and there's something there you're willing to take. But they're unquestionably, the supply is constrained, right? For a whole host of reasons, chips being prominent among those, as you listed. Demand is up. So it's all of the coincident events on the supply side and the demand side that have made it more difficult to get the car of your choice these days, for sure.
Spencer, how much is demand up? I mean, we've talked about, you know, how the car market has been hot, certainly throughout the pandemic, because people couldn't go anywhere, so they needed a car so they could go somewhere locally. How much is the demand increased, or how much has the demand increased when it comes to EVs specifically?
Well, I think it's unquestionably up. I'll just give you an example. It is more anecdotal than a sort of a global metric. So we have two dealerships in California that in the month of March of last year, so this is before even some of the most, forceful events occurred, the war in Ukraine and others that have put the constraint on. But we had two dealerships the month of March last year that sold more all-electric vehicles than internal combustion engine vehicles.
Wow.
First time we ever experienced that at an Audi dealership anywhere in the U.S. So I think you already saw that latent demand increasing and kind of manifesting even as early as spring of last year.
Spencer, a few questions here. I mean, California has been a leader in the country when it comes to EVs. I mean, it was weird to see Teslas outside of California at certain points over the last 10 years. But if you go to California, they're all over, and they have been for years. Where in California were these dealerships? And is this getting close anywhere outside of California? And finally, is this because of tax credits at all?
Yeah, for sure. We haven't like deconstructed and created the full attribution of why this was the case. I mean, all of these things factor in. The dealership locations, one was in the Bay Area, one was near San Diego.
Interesting.
For example, so, you know, a pretty wide distance. I think California's got a lot of programs, but there's just the infrastructure in place, mm-hmm. for example, that makes, I think, people feel that it's a more realistic option. They can go wherever they need to in the state.
And like you said, in some places, $7 gas at some points. That doesn't...
Well, but again, remember, March of 2021, where we saw this behavior, I think you see in the Pacific Northwest and the Seattle area, demand's quite high. But even in places like Texas and Florida, we're selling a bunch of our all-electric vehicles. I think it's a great product.
Fast Company did a story, why this climate scientist now works for a car company. Spencer, it's a great question. Why is it? And why did you...
You were that climate scientist, by the way.
Exactly. So help us make the connection and why you wanted to be there and why it works.
Sure. Well, listen, I mean, it's a multifaceted sort of story, but the upshot is this. In the U.S., the top source of greenhouse gas emissions of carbon dioxide specifically come from the transportation sector. I've been studying various elements of the climate problem, whether it be the impacts affecting our coastlines and how you reduce those impacts. But at the end of the day, it's about, you know, action that we need to take as a country. And within the private sector, there is this sort of confluence of factors that are pushing us towards a really unprecedented transformation. And Audi was positioned, when I was evaluating sort of the options in the industry, they really appeared positioned to take a very bold step forward. And that's why I joined Audi, to help them really push through, you know, some of the internal resistance. Like, you know, there's intrinsic risk, right? Back in 2018, it wasn't evident, clearly, that this was going to be a full transformation. Now I think there's a lot more evidence that we're heading, as you noted at the top of the program, we're hitting some tipping points. That was not the case in 2017, 2018 when I joined.
Spencer, is there any part of the supply chain of or the construction of an electric vehicle, namely the battery and the components that go into a battery, that give you pause from a sustainability perspective, since you are still relying on so many raw materials?
There is, but I don't think it's really unique to an electric vehicle. I mean, all the things that we consume in society have impacts on the environment in terms of raw materials. And I think there's been some hyperbole injected into the conversation around electric vehicles, that they are somehow unique in this regard. We use a lot of raw materials to build all the things that we use and consume day to day. Lithium, cobalt, those are issues that the industry is hyper-focused on with the broader ecosystem of suppliers. The nice thing about this situation is once we get sort of a critical mass of EVs in the market, the materials in those batteries are fully recoverable. There is a closed loop recycling opportunity that companies like Redwood, which Audi is partnering with now, they're based out of Nevada, that they have this developed in terms of this vision. They will take nothing to landfill. The raw materials that need to be extracted from the earth will dwindle over time, and they can just create this closed loop system. So to me, this is such a lovely story in terms of where we're heading. In the meantime, certainly attention is warranted on how we procure those raw materials. Is it done in the right way? And I think the world's attention on those is justified. But again, I would say that the uniqueness of this situation for EVs is something that is not really warranted. It's a situation that applies to everything that we use and consume.
Do you feel like governments globally are taking bold enough moves for us to fully embrace EVs? Because I still think about the lack of infrastructure. Are we not being bold enough as a government?
I think that's correct. Listen, if you just look at our investment, Audi's investment alone in electrification over the next 4+ years, we're investing $19 billion with a B. Mm-hmm. The big investment that everyone's touting in terms of the federal government here in the U.S. in infrastructure is $7.5 billion. Wow. I mean, that's an order of magnitude lower than what we're as one company putting into this space. So I think unequivocally, there needs to be more resources put into this. Now, you've got states like California that have put historically a lot of money into this, but there is no question that, and I'm talking about the U.S. here, that we need multiples of what's being discussed right now to really pull off the full transformation that people really, at least those, who want this, are touting.
What is the R&D now that we see a lot more EVs coming out of global automakers?
Well, on the use side, once the vehicle's in the customer's hands, I mean, there are places like the city of Seattle, for example, that has essentially a zero carbon electricity grid because of investments they've made over a long period of time. California's converging on a zero emissions grid as well in the next few years. So I think from the use phase, that sort of zero tailpipe emissions, even if you go upstream, that we're close to hitting that already in many parts of the country. If you look at the vehicle from, the full life cycle, the materials you extract from the ground, the manufacturing processes, in terms of what we control, we're working on that every day to reduce the carbon intensity of all of those steps. We're a ways away from that as an industry, and certainly as a society, we've got to decarbonize all of the economy, and then we get into conversations around carbon pricing, which politically is sort of a third rail right now. I think we're headed in a good direction. We have a lot more work to do, but I think we're farther along than some people might suggest.
That was Spencer Reeder, Director of Sustainability and Government Affairs at Audi of America. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Ahead in our next hour, we go from the road to the sky, only to find a traffic jam at 400 feet. This week's Business Week cover story explains the U.S. government's complicated and multi-year effort to establish a set of rules for commercial drones.
Yeah, it's got to be incredibly complicated. All right, staying in the skies, we'll also get an update on Frontier and JetBlue's battle to buy Spirit Airlines.
Certainly, these airlines are eager to get their hands on some aircraft and expand and be able to take advantage of that red-hot leisure demand in the U.S.
This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including a standoff in the skies. We go inside the battle over Spirit Airlines.
Plus, looking for a luxury getaway? The CEO of hospitality company Montage International says go for it and expect to pay a pretty penny for it.
All right, I am looking, but I don't know if I want to pay a lot for it. All right, first up this hour, this week's cover story. For years, NASA and the FAA have tried to create air traffic control rules for drones. If they both get it right, the network would be the most important development in U.S. transportation infrastructure since the interstate highway system.
Here to unwind that fabulously complicated effort is a Bloomberg Business Week contributor, Chris Feliciano Arnold.
It's interesting that in some respects, this future, we've been hearing about it for a long time, as you mentioned, almost 10 years now. And in some respects, the future is here. The advances in electric propulsion and battery technology have really made drones really exciting, what they're capable of in terms of their forms and capabilities. And yet, for a variety of reasons, that science fiction-like future we were told hasn't yet arrived. And one thing that I was surprised to find out is that one of the most complex tasks in making that future come to fruition isn't so much the hardware challenges, but more so the air traffic control challenge of managing what's amounting to an exponential increase in air traffic as regulators consider what it means to introduce potentially millions of new drones into the airspace.
I have to say, you want to get freaked out, Chris, you got to check this story, check it out online, because it has that idea of like, ultimately, how many drones, I guess, are going to be up in the air and just, you know, kind of how crowded our airspace.
The cover is literally a video.
It is. Yeah. And how crowded our airspace is going to get.
You've got pizza boxes and toilet paper flying at you, Carol.
Hot coffee, perhaps. That really kind of freaks me out. So enter NASA and the FAA. These are two areas of our government and our world that make sure people fly safely and make sure that when we shoot stuff up into space, it goes well. They've got to get it right. They're going to get it right, right?
Safety is the first and foremost concern for these federal agencies. And to put this in context, right now in the United States, there's about 200,000 planes and helicopters in active use. And at any point in time, even during peak hours, there's just over 5,000 aircraft in the air. Well, if we look forward to a world in which there's drone delivery, in which users can summon delivery drones on demand at any time of day or night for, you know, a burrito, a beer, coffee, pharmacy, medication, or whatnot, that is going to be an enormous increase in air traffic. And what has NASA and the FAA so concerned is, how are these drones, many of which are going to be flying below 400 feet in what has traditionally been uncontrolled airspace, how will they be sharing that airspace with planes that are operated by humans, while many of these drones will be operated semi-autonomously? And it creates a really confusing mix and a picture in which even the slightest error can cause a chain reaction that could put lives in jeopardy.
So, okay, this is where I'm like, wait a minute, it's going to be run by humans? Although they've done a good job with air traffic control, I guess, right?
On.
So should I feel good about that? Or would an algorithm that can figure it all out and make sure, I don't know, should I trust an algorithm more?
Yeah, so that's the interesting thing is that, in fact, this is going to be sort of an intersection for the time being of human air traffic control and computer algorithmic air traffic control. So traditionally, when we think about the task of an air traffic controller, it's all about being able to pay close attention to that work for long stretches of time, being able to act with stability under pressure. Well, that's one thing to manage that in the context of a few thousand aircraft. But when we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these operations per day, that's obviously a greater scale than any number of human air traffic controllers can manage. Enter the algorithms. And yet, although the software and big data is incredibly powerful, there's all sorts of other variables to consider, including connectivity with other devices. How are these devices connecting with each other? How are they connecting with the ground? What happens if a network goes out? What happens if a nefarious actor tries to interfere with the
5G
network?
5G interference, or what is it that's supposed to interfere with
5G.
Like planes, right?
Yeah, so there's incredible number of factors that can interfere, not to mention just the everyday things like bird strikes or strange weather or other unpredictable events. And so it's the sort of thing that algorithms are certainly going to play a huge role, and wireless connectivity is going to play a huge role in making sure that these objects aren't colliding. But we're introducing so many new types of aircraft for so many purposes.
Right.
That there's so many potential unintended consequences.
Okay.
And that's what I think the FAA and NASA are really trying to get ahead of.
Well, that's where I want to end with you, are unintended consequences of this technology. We think about, you know, crashes, and those would be terrible. But what about the idea that drones could be invading our personal space and could be worries about civil liberties, or they could be used to traffic drugs or drop weapons in places that where there shouldn't be weapons?
Absolutely. I mean, we've already seen this recently, even with that drone that was mysteriously flying over Yankee Stadium the other night, that we need to be able to know, like, where are these aircraft and what are they doing? Where ought they be able to fly?
Right.
When? How low? How loud? What sort of data should they be able to collect, whether it's video or audio? How long should that data be able to be stored? There's innumerable questions that need to be answered. And I think one of the big questions of this story is, how fast are regulators willing to move versus how fast are these companies wanting to move?
After doing this story, do you feel like, I mean, drones are coming, get ready for it, everybody, and we'll do it safely? We can do this?
I think they will be here sooner than we think. And I think that for all of our sake, I hope that it does. We can do so safely.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Chris Feliciano-Arnold. Check out the cover story in this week's issue on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
You ready for drones in the air?
No, I'm not.
Okay, just checking.
I mean, helicopters drive me crazy.
Get ready, kiddo. I have a feeling they're coming.
Oh, all right. They've been saying that for years.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Coming up, the CEO of luxury hospitality company Montage International on sustained demand despite inflationary pressures.
This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
You might recall back in May, Bloomberg Pursuit's travel editor Nikki Eckstein had a story that mentioned Virtuoso, the global consortium for luxury travel specialists, were seeing a 50% increase from a year earlier in the number of people seeking its services. Basically, people wanted to travel, Tim, and they wanted help in doing so.
Our next guest knows a thing or two about high-end leisure. Alan Furstman is founder and CEO at Montage International. It's a luxury hospitality management company. The company has properties in places like the Bahamas, Laguna Beach, California, Los Cabos, Mexico, and more.
Sign me up. I'm going to say all
of
them.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'll go.
All of the above. It's also a company that's expanding with new locations and development, overcoming the doubts created by the onset of the pandemic back in March of 2020.
COVID was traumatic, but once the vaccines were prevalent, we saw a return to business levels, and the last 2 years have been exceptionally strong for our company. And we've been particularly busy opening new hotels and resorts. Over an 18-month period in the last couple of years, we opened 6 new hotels, both Montage and Pendry's.
Okay, so bring us up to speed now on where you are, because at the same time, with the hike and with the, you know, increase in demand that we've been seeing when people wanted to get back out, at the same time, it's been tough for companies like yours to find talent, to find the people to actually help, staff these hotels, these properties. Give us an update there.
Yeah, well, staffing's been, from an industry perspective, the biggest challenge. We've been, it's not a one size fits all problem. Some markets rebounded much more quickly than others. For example, Laguna Beach, our Montage there is fully staffed, been so for a while now. It's a stronger labor market, but the emphasis on hiring, retaining, recruiting, training, and the creativity to get the best talent has never been more important. And assisting in finding housing and relocating people to different markets to help support those markets where you don't have folks has become a keen focus for our industry.
Are you paying? Are you having to continue to pay though a lot more for those workers?
Yeah, wages have gone up. That was a reality of supply and demand, but not nothing that we didn't expect actually, and that you've seen it actually in room rates. Much of that's been passed on obviously to our guests, but we've been we've adjusted rates and incentives and done whatever we can to stay fully staffed.
Are there other inflationary pressures that are impacting you guys as well? And I think about food, transportation. What else is putting a little bit of pressure
it's
on
across
the business?
The board?
Yeah,
the supply chain issues wreaked havoc on the construction we were doing and building our newer hotels and also getting product. So it's created pressure on pricing on virtually everything we buy. Mm. And that's been the reality we've dealt with over the past 6-8 months.
How have you passed along these prices to guests at this point? How much have you had to raise prices since pre-pandemic?
There's been price increases. We've been the leader in the rate leader in the markets that we perform, but for us, it's also about what kind of value are you adding. Mm-hmm. So our focus needs to be not just on price increasing, but what other value things can you do. For example, Montage Laguna Beach, where I'm sitting today, we've added new amenities and services that we didn't have before. Entertainment at the pool 7 days a week, and a virtuality experience, and some other things to help make it a value proposition, not just a price proposition.
So tell us about how it all works. Do you actually own all the properties? Are you just overseeing them? How does it work?
We're a hotel management company,
okay.
Not unlike Four Seasons, Ritz-Carlton, Marriott. So we manage luxury properties. Often we'll take the lead role in finding new opportunities and work with hotel developers and owners. And then we provide the brand standards and creative energy to continue to put forward great Montage and Penry hotels.
Where are you seeing the opportunities right now for expansion? For growth,
resort destinations, which have always been a strong suit for Montage, and we're seeing great urban opportunities for Penry, and there'll be some for Montage as well. Major gateway cities, there's great interest internationally. When we open our hotel in New York City, our Penry Manhattan West, it has been incredibly well received, and of course that's given us great visibility. In fact, it's the number one hotel in New York on TripAdvisor right now. We've had just incredible support, and it's created even greater interest for hotel developers, owners, as they look to build new iconic hotels.
Well, and I do wonder, Alan, you guys play definitely into the high end, and I wonder about, how much you think or see your consumer is pretty resilient to the economy, because we are talking so much here at Bloomberg, right, about what's going on, questions, 50%, I think one of the latest stories on the Bloomberg about a 50% chance of a recession in the making. So is that something that you have to be really that concerned about, or is your consumer, they can deal with it?
They can deal with it better, but okay. We deal with recessions. We, in 2011, 09, 10, we felt it as well. But luxury tends to bounce back quicker, a little more resilient. There's a reduction in spending even at the ultra high end in a recession. But we are much more insulated than different products.
I was thinking, Carol and I've been talking a lot about, I don't know, the other
getting away.
Put it. Yeah, but travel is miserable right now. And flights are miserable if you have to fly commercial. Right?
Or limited, yeah.
Which most people do, of course. Yeah. So, Alan, I'm wondering if you're seeing, if that concerns you at all, that it's just so difficult for families to get to these places in some cases that they're saying, you know what? We're just not going to go. We're going to drive somewhere because it's not worth the hassle. Is that concerning you?
It does. But in fact, I think, been somewhat of a beneficiary of that, because the locations where our hotels and resorts are haven't had the same level of challenges that some of the other markets. I mean, try going to Europe today and, and watching the news and seeing what's happening. Where's your luggage going and what kind of lines and what kind of problems you're going to face. I think that actually is driving greater interest in North American travel and resorts. And we have some great drive-to destinations also, which completely removes the hassle of air travel for now.
Big thanks to Alan Furstman, the founder and CEO at Montage International. Of course, to get to his properties, many customers have to fly. And as we know, Carol, airlines have been canceling and delaying trips all summer.
Fly, details. All right, delayed flights. Well, what about delayed deals? Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, we'll talk about two companies' ongoing battle over Spirit Airlines.
This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum, powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor, QNB. join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Flight delays and cancellations have battered the airline industry over the past few months. We got an update on the industry this past week, thanks to United Airlines and American Airlines reporting their quarterly results. Both airlines announcing they will limit flying for the rest of the year because of flight disruptions, things like labor shortages, air traffic control issues, and higher fuel costs.
Despite all of these challenges, though, there's some M&A happening in the space. Crew shortages and rising fuel and operating costs have sparked a bidding war over Spirit Airlines. Spirit has postponed a shareholder vote on a proposed merger with Frontier four times, with investors also weighing a competing offer from JetBlue.
Tim and Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld spoke with Bloomberg Opinion M&A and Industrials columnist Brooke Sutherland, along with Businessweek editor Joel Weber, to find out why Spirit is worth fighting for.
Sam Bankman-Fried has really spotted a lot of opportunities here to just consolidate power over the industry, whether it's striking deals with BlockFi or Voyager Digital. He's really, you know, just spreading his influence.
All right, remind us, for those who are like, wait, who is this dude? Because he really is a standout among those who are in this space, because he's worth a lot of money, right? He's probably lost some, but he's still worth a lot.
Yeah, he's worth about $10 billion currently to our Billionaires Index. That's about half of where his wealth was in April. Obviously still a lot of money. But he's 30 years old. He's taken the industry by storm. His companies, FTX and Alameda Research, have really asserted power within the industry. They work with a lot of top names. FTX is one of the most used crypto exchanges in the world.
So he's doing all of this out of the goodness of his heart, or does he just want to dominate and be the industry?
A lot of people within the industry see him as crypto's patron saint, that he is stepping in, bailing out companies out of the goodness of his own heart. But others see a business motivation here. He's really buying companies on the cheap. He is stepping in, he's helping out, but there's also a huge advantage in expanding his own business and gaining customers all over the world, particularly in the U.S.
Tell us more about what he's like and who he is and how he got into crypto.
Yeah, no. Sam is always great to talk to. We spoke to him for this story. He is described by people as kind, nerdy, shy, a little bit awkward, but he really has a very calculating eye when he looks at the industry. He got into crypto trading a few years back, really sort of climbed the ranks in terms of trading performance with Alameda Research. And he really has become a kind of a cult figure within the industry. And he's also pledged to give away most of his vast personal wealth.
While he's spending and buying and looking to dominate when it comes to crypto, he's passed on some of the big flops as of late.
That's true. We have in our reporting that he spoke with Terra and Celsius about potential bailouts there, but he ended up passing on both. So it shows that he does have a discriminating eye here. He's not just bailing out whoever. He's looking for advantages. He's looking at how it can help him and his companies.
What about when it comes to Robinhood?
Yeah, no. We reported a few weeks back that he was looking into a potential takeover at Robinhood. This shows that he has his eyes beyond the crypto industry, that he's looking at sort of more traditional finance players. As one of my sources said, his ambitions know no bounds. So it's really exciting to see him look at other areas. I mean, he's even joked about buying Goldman in the past.
That is wild. Well, he wants to do bigger deals, it sounds like. Hannah, what is it that we need to understand about this individual, as the crypto space, still many who are knowledgeable, understand how it works, who are entrenched in this industry, say we're very early on in terms of the impact of the digital crypto world. So why is it that we need to keep an eye on him and what he does?
Well, I think with this current crypto winter, the industry is at a crossroads. A lot of people want a decentralized industry where power is in the hands of the people, that it's based on peer-to-peer transactions. But Sam's influence and that of FTX shows that there are clear centralized elements here, that there are major players to watch, and that they are going to have continued influence as this space grows.
So what are you watching to see in terms of what he does next?
Yeah, so we already know, and we reported that FTX and FTX US are looking to raise more funding, which is pretty interesting during this time because I've written a lot about how funding from venture capitalists has slowed when it comes to crypto. So he is definitely looking to expand. He has also spoken about buying assets from other distressed companies and even targeting Bitcoin miners.
We'll be keeping a close eye on that deal for updates and, of course, whether or not it ever closes. That was Bloomberg Opinion M&A and Industrials columnist Brooke Sutherland, along with Joel Weber. Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld joining us there as well.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. We've gone from ultra-luxury hotels to budget airlines. Coming up next, though, a different sort of trip.
How a psychedelic renaissance could give way to a new multi-billion dollar health and wellness market, and what stands in the way.
We'll explain on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
A meat alternative pulled from Yellowstone's hot springs, a sustainable fix for the leather market, a supplement to combat anxiety. The common denominator, we're talking about the magic of mushrooms.
Yeah, we've got some pretty delicious ones in there as well. The pursuit section this week, chock full of mushrooms, the many types of them, the applications of our favorite fungi, too. Here to tell us more is a pretty fun guy.
No.
I did it. It's Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser.
Dad jail.
I am in dad jail. But come on, it was worth it for your reaction, Chris.
It was.
I didn't know you could dedicate an entire section of the magazine to fun guy.
Yeah. Well, there's always a lot of fun, just not always so much fun guy. And now we have more mushrooms than you could have ever wanted.
Can I ask you, when you started to do this, were you like... saying to Joel Weber, the editor of the magazine, like, I don't know that we can do a whole section. Or did you be like, yeah, there's so much going on?
Oh, this was not Joel's idea. Joel said, we're doing what?
But as I was reading it, I was thinking to myself, how does something like this come together? Does somebody say, okay, well, I've got this great story on the applications of mushrooms for, you know, to replace leather. Mm-hmm. And someone else says, you know, Kate Crater maybe says, wait a second, mushrooms, they are so hot in kitchens around the country right now. Like, so, what happens here?
Well, in this case, our old former designer, Jackie, wanted to shoot pictures of mushrooms because she thinks they're fascinating to look at. And so she mentioned it, and I said, you know what? There are mushrooms everywhere. You walk down the street, coffee shops are like, have our mushroom coffee. The vitamin shop is like, have our mushroom immunity pills. And, you know, psychedelic mushrooms, everyone's talking about it. The other day, I was on the beach in Fire Island, and someone came up and was selling magic mushrooms, not like in a subtle way, like they had branded mushrooms and they were selling them at our green market in, like, psychedelic mushrooms in New York, openly selling in a green market. Like, this is, it's really happening. It's happening in a lot of different ways. Mushrooms have been waiting underground for this moment. And so we said, you know what, let's just do a whole section.
Did you buy them, Chris, on the beach?
I did not buy them on the beach, but I did get their card because I was curious about how, you know, they sell microdosing, they sell actual mushrooms, they sell
candies.
It's
incredible. It's an incredible moment.
All right, so back up a little bit, because as I was reading through this, I'm like, is this kind of akin to where cannabis was, I don't know, a few years ago?
Yeah, that's a good question. The cannabis market was much bigger and much more robust, and it had, and a lot more people went to jail for it. And this, the decriminalization of psychedelic mushrooms, so like regular mushrooms you can eat and supplements that might make you sleep better or help your immunity, those are all legal, but it's only decriminalized in a few places. And the slow decriminalization of psilocybin, the sale of it, is that
that's the good stuff,
the
right?
Sale and the owning of it is that it's the lowest priority for law enforcement, so you're not going to jail, you might get a fine.
Okay.
And that means that people are becoming more and more comfortable selling it sort of not really under the radar. You can go to meetups and swaps. There are churches where you can, you know, say you're a member of the church and you can buy it legally. And this is giving an opportunity for small businesses to get into the psilocybin game.
But they're operating in this, you know, kind of weird gray market area where it's not entirely legal,
yes,
but it's not totally criminalized, right?
Exactly. They're waiting for it to be legalized. Whereas weed becoming legal, it's happening on such a big scale and it's becoming regulated that only bigger companies that have a lot of money are able people to actually meet the requirements and get started quickly. So that's why you see, you know, people used to buy weed on the street, or you text somebody and they come, and now it's like a very fancy shop in Great Barrington, Massachusetts.
So true, right?
And like everything's really branded. And there's, you know, people are hoping, like advocates are hoping, that the way that they're slowly decriminalizing magic mushrooms will allow people who've been in this gray market and, you know, non-rich people to sort of get into this business.
Tell us about mushrooms, though, in terms of a therapeutic, especially magic mushrooms. I mean, there's evidence, or does the FDA weigh in on this? Like, and what can they do, and who can they help?
Yes. Yeah, so
there's a lot of questions.
Evidence, especially in the past couple of decades, that show that psychedelic mushrooms and other sort of psychedelic treatments can have real game-changing effects on mental health. They can help with memory. They can help with anxiety, depression. And, you know, people like Mark Bittman and Ayelet Waldman and other writers have sort of brought it into the mainstream with books that they've written. So people are more open to it, and more people are trying it. And it's in the pharmaceutical sense, it's about a $6 billion business now globally.
Right.
But it's going to be much bigger as governments legalize treatments, where you kind of would like go to a doctor and get a prescription for it. And then you go to a therapist and you do like a trip kind of experience.
Well, that's what I think is also interesting. And I'm trying to think, I think had a guest on air, but this whole idea of when you actually get into the psychedelic mushrooms, I guess it is, mm-hmm. that you have to be under a therapist, right? And it's you've really got to be watched over as you go through these treatments.
Yeah, I mean, that's how some people view it. And, you know, that's certainly how like big business is going to view it, so that you have to, you know, pay a lot. Your insurance might
that's
not
true,
cover
big
it.
Business.
But, you know, the tradition of being watched over while you're going on a trip is thousands of years old. You know, like it's an indigenous culture in a lot of places in North and South America, that you have someone guide you through it. And that's, you know, that's for a reason.
Okay, we're not just talking psychedelics here in this pursuit issue. I want to talk about eating mushrooms because they taste good, and perhaps because they're a good alternative to meat. I want to start with Kate Crater's article
about
the mushrooms
that
are so hot right now. They do look good, but yeah, I got to tell you, there are some people like my father-in-law, for example, who just will not touch a mushroom.
Mm-hmm. My husband is the same.
Does that change in 2022 with this like resurgence that we're seeing?
So there's a lot more mushrooms out there this year because it's been a rainy year. So literally there are just like more mushrooms growing. And then B, because places, farms are learning how to grow things like porcini and maitake mushrooms, which have actually really mostly been foraged. Suddenly now mushrooms are like more widely available in a lot more communities. So you're seeing them at restaurants a lot more places, which hopefully means that people like your dad and my husband will become more comfortable with it. Although in my experience, it's a texture thing and it's really hard to sell.
Wait, it's my father-in-law. My dad loves mushrooms.
Okay, father-in-law.
Yeah, my father-in-law.
He's like your husband, Chris. He's just like
and
won't
Carol.
Touch the things.
Sorry, guys. They look really cool, but I really don't love them.
But does that mean if people don't have to forage for them? Because if you forage for these, that can be very time-consuming and expensive. We're going to get to how you can actually do that in a minute. Does that mean these are getting a lot less expensive if you buy them in the grocery store because they're farmed now?
They are getting less expensive, and chefs are more easily, you know, able to put them on the table.
Can we get to one that I love? This I'm not going to say it right. The Fusarium of Yellowstone.
Yes. So there's this company that we've profiled, and I've interviewed the CEO before, called Nature's Find, which is a meat alternative, a company that scientifically makes protein. They use a microbe that NASA scientists found in a hot spring in Yellowstone. And when extracted, that microbe will ferment into just like vast sheets of protein. It's been tested on a SpaceX flight to see if it's good for to be used in space as astronaut food. It's on the menu at La Bernardin in several iterations, so expect to see this coming out into a market near you.
Okay, and it can be used potentially as a meat alternative, and we're not talking like a meat alternative, like a highly processed, you know,
doesn't look like a burger.
Exactly, like a burger, as a lot of people in the alternative meat category have come to know. And what I love about this story is there's a little shout out to Anthony Bourdain in here. You know, Eric Ripert basically says, now this is the type of meat alternative that Anthony Bourdain would have gone for.
Yeah, because it can help the world. It's so inexpensive to produce, and it happens so quickly that it's more inexpensive and more efficient, way more efficient than raising a bunch of chickens, for example. So the idea that we can sort of grow this quickly, and it's like tofu, it's very adaptable. It doesn't particularly taste delicious. Repair thought Bourdain would think that this was the perfect kind of food.
I love it too that it's all 9 essential amino acids, more protein and fiber than beef or peas. I mean, this is really nutritious.
Yes, very good for you.
We should point out that Nature's Find is backed by Bill Gates's Breakthrough Energy Ventures, but also another investor is Michael Bloomberg, of course, the founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. All right, I want to get to when fungus meets fashion.
Not just good for you, but can look good too.
Yeah.
Not just good for you, but so good for the planet.
Mushrooms, I guess, can be really strong and kind of be a substitute for leather?
Yeah, so the mycelial networks, which are sort of the fibers that extend under the ground that connect, or through trees that connect the little mushrooms that you see, is a very, very strong material. And so a lot of different companies are using it to create items like a fabric that's as tough as leather. And, you know, people are very interested out in the market about leather alternatives, and there's some that come from apple peels. There's others that come from other things, and the mycelial ones seem to be the most promising, and Stella McCartney makes one of her bags with it. It's becoming quite a thing.
Do we need it, though? I mean, there's plenty of leather out there, isn't there? Unfortunately.
There is, unfortunately, a lot of leather. We don't use all the leather that's out there.
Okay, but if we use less leather, does that mean if we eat less meat, does that mean there's going to be less leather?
Good point.
And also, yes. I think the backdrop of this, too, is that leather alternatives, a lot of them are petroleum-based. So even though they could be good for the world in the sense that you're not killing an animal for it, it's not good for the environment.
Yeah, and a lot of leather, people use plasticizers on leather. The people who are creating these alternatives are really trying to be sustainable in every way. And also it's about glamorizing leather. Like if we can glamorize an alternative material, maybe that helps us cut down on meat consumption.
There's also a whole section in Pursuits that talks about mushrooms as medicines. Did you try anything?
And I did. I tried these great supplements from First Person, which I brought if you guys want to try.
Yeah, you're holding these two sort of discs in your hand. And if you open them up, there are pills in there?
There are pills inside. Yeah, and these help during the day with energy and at night with sleep, and they say that they help with memory and stuff, and immunity. It definitely gives you energy and makes you feel sort of peppy. Okay. I wouldn't say makes you feel like you're on drugs, but it feels maybe like drug adjacent.
Chris, hook me up.
That's going to do it for Magic Mushrooms.
A big thank you to Bloomberg Pursuits editor Chris Rouser. I'm going to say it again. Fun guy to be with. Mm-hmm. Ready for Mushroom Pocketbook or some microdosing. Anything with Chris.
Is that dad jail? Is that where we have to put him, Chris?
Dad jail.
All right. That wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
Guilty as charged. I'm Tim Stenovic. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Have a great weekend, everyone.
Stay safe, all, and maybe check out the mushrooms. This is Bloomberg.